transform your life today. Welcome to Super Coach with Michael Neal.
Good morning, good afternoon, good evening, wherever you may be. Our topic for today is happiness is. And the numbers to call to get coaching on having what you want and thriving in every area of your life are 866-254-1579. That's toll-free in the United States and Canada, 866-254-1579. Or from outside the U.S., you can reach the show by dialing 001-760-918-4300. You can also follow along on Facebook at facebook.com/mneal. And if you make comments during the show, I can usually see them there. And on Twitter at Michael_Neal. And that all said, let me go ahead and set the table a little bit for our conversation today. So I used to be a real student of happiness. It was the most important subject in the world to me because I wasn't happy. You know, there's a saying that it's our unmet needs that motivate. Well, my unmet need for happiness meant that I became quite obsessive about studying everything that there was to do with happiness. So I would look at what religion would say about happiness. I would look at what personal development would say about happiness. I'd look at what various happy people had said about happiness, and I even looked at what unhappy people had to say about happiness. And for a time, it really looked to me like happiness was something that I could achieve, that if I worked at it hard enough, I could have it. And even though it was fleeting, like everyone seemed to agree on that, that, you know, it wasn't a permanent thing, that you know, with enough hard work, I could get a pretty regular bead on it. And I was willing to put in the hours. I was willing to do the work. So initially, that looked like doing the right things, right? I thought if I did the right things, then I would be happy. I kind of knew getting the right stuff wasn't going to do it. That one never really seduced me in the way that it does some people. It always kind of amused me that it wasn't really till the 1920s when Edward Bernays, who was Freud's nephew, got brought in to help retailers because they were found that, you know, this was before the Depression, but after the war, after World War I, people just weren't spending very much because they'd gotten used to getting by with very little. And so he was the one who came in and sort of say, oh, just show them how your stuff will make them happy. Right? Link their happiness to having your stuff, and then you'll sell more stuff even when people don't really need it. And that's, like, I could see that that's just a con that's been out there for a while. I mean, Bernays didn't invent it, but that never felt real to me. But it did look to me like if I did the right stuff, if I could just find my dream job, if I could just do the work that was the right work for me, then I would be happy. And so I put a lot of effort into doing that. And it kind of worked, except that then my biggest problem became getting work and getting the right work. And I kind of just had a new problem. So instead of my problem being, how do I get happy? It was, how do I get enough of the work that will make me happy? So that kind of didn't really do it. And then I sort of started looking at things that said, well, you can't chase happiness directly. So it's not really what you have or don't have. And it's not really what you do or don't do. It's what you think. So it's all thought created. So I got really into affirmations and trying to think the right thoughts and not think the wrong thoughts. And, you know, I wasn't content with your willpower affirmations where you just repeat it 10,000 times. I wanted to create the habit of positive thinking. So I used my neuro-linguistic programming skills to program in positivity and to direct my mind towards these thoughts that would create happiness. And then I did the Vanguard program in positive psychology coaching when Martin Seligman was still teaching it. And, you know, we looked at, well, okay, so I did gratitude journals and I did all these things that were supposed to foster a happier mindset. And it was a full-time job. So now, instead of working to get happy, or working to get the stuff that was going to make me happy, or working to get the work that was going to make me happy. Now I was working all the time to maintain and create the thinking that was going to make me happy. And I wasn't bad at it. I got to be honest. I did pretty well. I was pretty happy. You know, I created this thing I wrote about and feel happy now called Behavioral Prozac. And it was a set of 10 things that I would do every day, or pretty much all of them every day, that I'd found that if I do these 10 things every day, I'm pretty happy. But I still thought I was 2 weeks away from misery, right? They say every golfer is two shots away from breaking a club in anger. You know, no matter how well they're playing, no matter how good a player they are, you know, two bad shots and they'll lose it. Well, I was 2 weeks in my mind away, but I didn't worry about that because I thought I'm never going to go 2 weeks without doing this stuff. I can maintain this. I'm tough. I'm good enough. And darn it, people like me, right? I had my positive attitude in place. And then one day, without looking for it, without thinking it was a possibility, without having noticed that people had been saying things like this throughout my quest, I heard a guy on a video named Sid Banks. And he said, every human being has innate mental health. And the whole game spun on its axis for me. Because somehow I just knew that that was true. I knew that at core, we're born happy. It's our nature. There's a sense of well-being that comes with being alive. It's baby bliss, the bliss that babies live in when they're not hungry, angry, lonely, tired. It's the bliss that many people access through meditation, through walks in nature, through quiet daydreaming, when they're with their kids or with their loved ones or with their pets very often. That isn't an achievement. That's who you are. And that anything you would put in the second half of the sentence, happiness is, right? I used to do theater, and I did the play You're a Good Man, Charlie Brown, a number of times. And there's a song in there, Happiness Is. You know, morning and evening, daytime and nighttime too. And it's a list of all the things that happiness is. And happiness just is. Happiness is our nature. It is who we are. It is what we are made of. Now, not feeling good as opposed to feeling bad, right? There's happy that's the opposite of sad. That's not the happy I'm talking about. That is transient. That is temporal. That does come and go. But there is a well-being that is at the very core of who we are. A peace, a contentment, a spaciousness. And when we get quiet on the inside, no matter how busy we are on the outside, when we get quiet, it bubbles right up to the surface. It's right there. It's right here. It's right now. It's what it feels like to be alive without the burden of all your personal thinking about what you're supposed to be and what you're supposed to do and what you're supposed to have in order to be happy. It's who you are. And that does a really interesting thing to the game of life. So we're going to talk about that more in the minute. If you want to talk about this or whatever's on your mind, numbers to call 866-254-1579, toll free in the United States and Canada. Outside the U.S., you can reach me by dialing 001-760-918-4300. And I'm going to encourage you to call because I'm going to lose my voice otherwise, and that's going to make for bad radio. But But let me speak a little bit about this game of life thing. Right? So much of the game of life as we have learned to play it is what we think will make us happy. I'll be happy when I get a partner. I'll be happy when I get the right partner, a different partner. I'll be happy when my business is up and running. I'll be happy when I get a better job. I'll be happy when I have more money. I'll be happy when I have less money. I'll be happy when I'm older. I'd be happy if I was younger. We create so many conditions around this natural feeling. And then we spend so much of our time trying to fulfill those conditions, trying to make ourselves happy by getting the outside right. Now, the irony is that not only does it not work that way, not only will our happiness, lasting happiness, never come to us from the outside in, but so much of the busyness we create in our lives in order to try to create the conditions that we want in our lives because we think they will make us happy, distract us from our true nature. They take us away from the very thing that we're seeking. And so it becomes this weird kind of self-reinforcing loop where we become very busy-minded, and so we lose touch with that good feeling inside us. And then in our busyness, we think, man, I need that good feeling. And we get even busier. And so the game goes. Now, here's what's interesting. When you get happy, and what I mean by that is when you stop running around trying to get happy, and you recognize that it's already right there inside you, you don't drop out of life. There are very few people that I know do. You might give yourself a break if you've been pushing too hard for too long. You might cut back. But on the whole, you engage at a deeper level. You engage at a more human level. Your life becomes more about people and less about things. It becomes more about love and less about ideas. It becomes more about the day-to-day and less about the vision for the future. And that's not to say that any of those other things are bad or wrong or you mustn't do them, because how would I know? I can just share with you that as I've gotten quieter, I've still engaged with life. I've just engaged with the world at a level that wasn't possible for me before. Right? You know, you've probably got a friend that you wish could get out of their heads long enough to really notice what's going on in your life. You might even be married to them or related to them. And you just wish that they weren't so consumed by what's going on for them that they could see what's going on for you. And I can guarantee you, you've got a friend who thinks that about you. Now, you might be a really loving, caring person. You probably are, if you're interested in this kind of conversation. But we get caught up. We lose our bearings. We think, you know, when I'm happy, I'll be a better friend, which is true. But we think that there's a step to take to get from wherever we are to happy. We think there's a journey to go on. We think there's a distance to travel. It's like, I don't know if you've, can't remember what it's called, but there is a new virtual reality game that they've been testing out at a lot of malls. They've been doing it at one of the malls near here, and they were doing it at the Mall of America in Minneapolis when I was there a couple weeks ago. And you'd see people and they'd put these helmets on and it would transport them into this other world. And they would be so in this other world that they had to have somebody standing near them to make sure they didn't fall over or knock into things. Now imagine that one of those people got so caught up in their virtual reality that they wanted to go to the mall. And they didn't realize that they were standing in the mall with a helmet on. And so they would ask their virtual reality guides for directions to the mall because they knew that the mall was where they really wanted to be. And the guides who were also lost in their virtual reality worlds would give them all sorts of directions about how to find their way to the mall and what was necessary to get to the mall. And they might say, oh, it's really easy. You just have to do this. Or they might say, oh, it's really hard and takes a lot of discipline. You have to do this and this and this and this. But they would all be sharing their advice based on a fundamental misperception. The idea that you weren't already in the mall. When in fact, the second you switch off the helmet, here you are in the mall. Well, this is us. The second we switch off our virtual reality projector, which is to say we quiet our personal thinking, we stop paying so much attention to the noise in our heads and become more present to where we are. We're already at the mall. We're already happy. We're already in the well of our being. We just didn't notice. You know, there's a famous quote. I think it was Meher Baba who, before his vow of silence, I guess it must have been, came to America and got off the plane and said, they live in paradise, but they don't know it. And because he didn't talk much, I don't think anybody ever figured out whether he was saying New York was paradise, where his plane landed, you know, America was paradise, or something deeper. And I like to think, because of everything else that he said in his life and did, that he was talking about something deeper. He was talking about the human condition. We live in paradise. We live in the infinite energy of creation. We live in God. But we don't know it. And boy, do we do a lot to try and capture even a little bit of what we already have. And it's just a misunderstanding. But it's a misunderstanding that's been shared by so many people for so long that it really looks for all the world like, no, you've got to do stuff if you want to be happy. You've got to earn it. You know, you've got to go out there and get some. Now, here's what's interesting. Happy people, in my experience, are out in the world. They're drawn to do stuff, and they do it to the best of their abilities. And sometimes it's stuff that to you or I might look very mundane, very ordinary. And sometimes it's stuff that to you and I look amazing. But because they're not engaging with the world to get happy, they're engaging with the world from their happiness. Not only do they have a completely different experience of things, but we wind up having a completely different experience of them. We wind up kind of dropping back into our own happiness when we're around them. You ever notice that? You're with somebody who's really kind of happy and at peace, and you just chill out in their presence. But we have these things in the front of our brain called mirror neurons. And they're designed to pick up on what's coming from whatever we're engaged with. And that's where empathy comes from. It's a natural brain function. But it can't override a busy mind. So if somebody's so caught up in their little drama, if they're so caught up in all that they are doing to deal with what they think is between them and happiness, they could be in a room full of happy people and they wouldn't even notice. They could even be living in paradise and not notice. And so there's something beautiful that starts to happen when we make space inside and out to quiet down. Now, you don't have to do anything, right? Just being available to the space is enough. It's like somebody who's in a pond saying, hey, how do I get wet? You're already wet. You're just not really in the pond because you're off in your thinking, fantasizing about the future, obsessing about the past, obsessing about the future, fantasizing about the past. You're living in the experience of thought. And so you don't notice that at a deeper level, it's all unfolding inside the ocean. You're already in the pond. You're already soaked through with love. You're soaked through with life energy. You're soaked through with God. But you don't notice. And so that's why we so want stuff to do. Give me something to do, for Christ's sake. Throw me a bone. Tell me what to do and I'll do it. These are all things I've heard from clients, from callers over the years. But there's nothing to do. There is something to see. There is something to notice. There is something to wake up to. But how do you wake up when you're asleep? Well, if you don't know you're asleep, you can't. Right? I mean, now, if you know you're asleep, if you realize you're asleep and you try to wake up, people usually find a way. Right? In that moment where they realize, oh my gosh, they're asleep, they've already begun to wake up. And then they can kind of take themselves the rest of the way. Something will occur to them in the moment. They'll punch their arm or they'll scream in their dream and it brings them out of it. Or they'll open their eyes really wide in their dream and it will somehow open them on the outside. You find a way. But if you think that your job is to solve something inside the dream, that thought is going to stop you from noticing you're asleep, which is going to stop you from waking up. Now, it can't completely stop you because we're made to wake up. We're made to fall asleep again. And then we're made to wake up again. That's part of the design. Why are we designed that way? No idea. Couldn't tell you. But very clearly, human beings are made in such a way that we easily lose our bearings and get lost in thought. And that we inevitably, accidentally, at certain moments in our life, wake up to the dream. Wake up to the ever-present reality of God, of life, of love, of happiness. And if we don't have a framework for it, we attribute it. We attribute that weird sudden feeling of relief and well-being to a book we just read. And so we carry the book around or we look for other books like it. We attribute it to the person that we just listened to on the radio. And so we listen to them more. We find other people to listen to who are similar. We attribute it to a drug that we just took or a trip that we took or a place that we went to. And so we want to go back to that place and find other places like it. But when you see that, no, actually what happened was you just touched God. You just touched your true nature. Well, that's a whole different thing. That doesn't create more activity. That gives you less to do. That doesn't give you more to think about. That takes a load off your mind. That leaves you with pure consciousness, uncontaminated by personal thinking. In the Inside Out Revolution, I share the story of a couple of friends who came back from a retreat where they were, you know, learning about these principles. And they said, you know, I asked them, well, what did you get? And they were very quiet inside. And I said to them, so what did you get? And they said, well, more full stops, less commas. They were British, so if they were American, they would have said more periods, less commas. They just started to notice life is, period. Not life is, and therefore we need to blah, 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 blah. They might notice I'm upset, full stop. Not I'm upset, comma, because so-and-so did this to me, comma, and therefore I need to do this, comma, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. We get quieter on the inside, naturally, without having to do anything in order to get quiet. And in that quiet, we feel ourselves, our deeper selves, our deeper nature. And from that place, we can do anything. We can go out and live our lives. We can have great relationships. People are going to be drawn to us. And if we like, when they show up, we can bill them. That'll take care of the money thing. And life just has a kind of an ease to it. Because when things work out, it's great. That was fantastic. Let's go get some ice cream. And when they don't work out the way you want, we can go, well, that's a bummer. Let's go get some ice cream. And it's just natural. It's just life looks different from a quieter place, from a calmer place, from a more settled place than it does when you're all up in it, when you're all up and you're thinking about it, when you're shaking your head back and forth and trying to see straight. Let's go to the phones. Let's talk to Lisa in Leadville. Lisa, welcome to the show. What are we going to talk about today?
Hey, Michael. Good afternoon. Thank you so much.
You're welcome.
You know, for me and my practice and what I share with my clients and students is that gratitude is the quickest way to happiness. And we sometimes forget that. We get so wrapped up and warped up. And what we don't have is we forget to just say, hey, this is what I do have. And just that frequency of acknowledging that increases our happiness exponentially.
Now, you tell me if this ever happens to you, because When I was studying positive psychology and doing that, we did a lot of work on gratitude. There was a lot of research into gratitude. And I always reckoned that they had the cause effect a little bit backwards. Because here's what I've seen, and you might not have seen this in your practice, but I'm just actually genuinely curious. Some people, not all, have so much thinking about gratitude that when they start focusing on gratitude, it revs them up. It brings up guilt. It brings up shame. It brings up, I should be content. Oh, you're right. You're right. You're absolutely. I mean, it's always you're right, right? They always start with that. But you're right. I should be more grateful. I should. Now, if they can get past that, it has been my experience that they start to see the reality of every single thing we have in our lives is a gift. But in my work, I've seen people bump up against all this extra thinking around gratitude. And I'm just curious if you found that at all.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
And that is something that moves towards the am I worthy? And that does have to be addressed as well. And yes, you are worthy. And the choice for choosing that guilt, that is something that with the energy work that we do, with the witnessing and recognizing it, saying, okay, just hold that frequency and vibration of your guilt. Love it to the light, let it go. It's, you know, that is peeling back these layers and then be grateful for that guilt. Sometimes guilt keeps us safe. Sometimes these less than delightful emotions, they do have a imbalance. They do have a place and a space within us, and we're not saying anything about resisting those. But to witness those surrender those to get to the goodness, the godness, the gratitude. I think it is possible for each of us, but it is a choice.
Thank you, Lisa.
Thanks, Michael.
So now, here's, and I want to be careful about this, because I think anything that you have found that brings you peace, I'm all for. Right? We had some family members who joined a, let's call it a fringe religion. Some people would call it a religious cult. We'll call it a fringe religion. And people in the family were very upset about this. Until, after a couple of years, it became obvious that they genuinely become more peaceful and happier in themselves. And even though nobody else in the family became interested in the fringe religion, they kind of lost their judgment of it, because, you know what, worked for them. So if something works for you, I don't want to imply that you should stop doing it. But what I do want to point to is how much work there is in practicing something to notice what is already present. So even in that description of practicing gratitude, and then, well, yeah, well, then you've got to resolve the worthiness issue. And then, well, there's energy work to do around that. And then there's holding. Now, I know from doing things like that, you can get there. There's no question in my mind that somebody who is drawn to that path and who sticks that path out and does the practice will find their way home. And the question is, do they recognize it as home when they get there? Or do they think they need to keep driving the vehicle, practicing the practice, in order to stay there? I used to spend a lot of time, I'm wondering if this next segment is going to be subtitled, "How many people can Michael piss off in the next segment?" I don't mean to. I don't think I will. If I do, I was just kidding. I used to do a lot of the work of Byron Katie, and it's beautiful, and Katie is beautiful. If you've ever had the chance to spend time with her, you know what I mean, and if you've not had the chance to spend time with her, go spend time with her. Go do her school. Go do, you know, she does a New Year's cleanse every year. You know, find a place where you can just be in her presence. You'll have an amazing... universe or an engineer with a sense of humor going, uh-oh, he's about to say something controversial. Quick, kick him off, kick him off. I'm going to try again. If I get kicked off again, then apparently I'm not supposed to talk about this stuff. What I was actually in the midst of saying, though, was really nice things about Byron Katie, because I absolutely love her. I've had the chance to meet her a few times. She's an amazing woman. However, here's why I brought it up. What I saw in people doing the work is they would carry around their notebooks and they would write down every negative thought that they had and every limiting thought that they had and every upset feeling that they had, so that they'd have more stuff to do the work on. And it was almost like people got so much pleasure from the relief of getting past their thinking that became the goal, instead of finding that deeper place of peace that we are, which is the whole purpose of the work in the first place. So it would be like you have a boat and you're incredibly grateful for your boat because it got you across the river to your home. But then you keep trying to row it on dry land and wonder why it's not working so well and think, maybe I need a bigger boat. Well, no, you're home. Like, I look in my own work and I look back, and one of the reasons that I committed 15 years of my life to neurolinguistic programming was because I had my first experience, one of my first experiences of true inner peace during an NLP exercise. And I, as a suicidal depressive, that was pretty impressive to me. That was something I really wanted more of. And so because it happened doing an NLP exercise, I thought, I want more NLP exercises. I need to learn everything about this. And I learned a lot of amazing things. And I got the chance to do a lot of amazing work with some wonderful people. But I was talking to Robert Holden. He and I were walking through a hotel looking at a possible venue for an event. And I realized it was the hotel where I'd done my first NLP training. And I just had this epiphany in the lobby that had somebody told me when I experienced that moment of pure bliss, of pure peace, dude, we were in California, they would have said, dude, that's your true nature. And I'd been able to hear them. That would have saved me 15 years. Now, they were enjoyable years. I don't regret them. But it makes me smile sometimes to think how much time I put into discovering that I already had what I was looking for. Let's go back to the phones. Let's talk to Vanessa in Boston. Vanessa, welcome to the show. What are we going to talk about?
Hey, am I on?
Yes, you are.
Hi. So I have a mature meditation practice, and I love it. It makes me feel great. And
is there such a thing as an immature meditation practice? I would love to be part of that. I don't want to be quiet. You can't make me be quiet.
Maybe, I'm maturing. I'm not like old lady meditator, but I'm maturing and I'm getting there and I'm feeling.
I gotcha.
You know, I'm feeling in the sweet spot and kind of practicing it day to day and really maintaining vigilance in my mind. And it makes me feel happy. And I think that part of the hump that I had to get over when I was trying to find happiness, and again, I'm happy today. I might not be tomorrow, but right now I'm happy. I think part of the hump was that I was just thinking about it too much. And maybe this is what you found too. But now what I do when I go dark and stormy is I tend to like reach out to somebody else and say, how can I help you? How can I turn this away from me and turn to somebody else to serve? And then the other thing that I try to do to maintain that composed, happy feeling is to kind of feel completely within the happy moments while they're happening. So really experiencing them. And I think that brings that idea back to gratitude, where when you know you're in a great moment and you sort of memorize it and you can fully experience the gratitude, I think that's sort of that magic point of the practice where you can hold on to that. So when the bad stuff or the mundane stuff does happen, you've sort of already memorized that feeling and can walk through life holding on to that.
So let me run a metaphor by you. Okay. This is a metaphor I shared with a group called Living from Mind. There's a program that we're doing at supercoach.com. And it was the idea of the eye of the storm. You know how in the center of any storm, there's a calm, a quiet. And when the storm passes over, if you're in the eye of the storm, it's almost eerily quiet in that place. Now, let's say that you live in the desert and you know that one of the things that happens in the desert is sandstorms. And sandstorms can be really nasty and incredibly disorienting. And people, it's one of the ways people die in the desert is trying to navigate a sandstorm. And the strategy, according to my desert nomad friends, because I've never been in one, but the strategy that I have been told is that you stay where you are because the storm will pass and then you'll be right where you need to be. Now, it seems to me that when we find our center, whether it's through meditation, whether it's through gratitude, whether we stumble into it, there will be thought storms. There will be life events that stir us up and create a lot of noise. And if we don't try to do anything about that, then when the storm settles, which it always will because that's the nature of storms, we'll be right at home where we always were. Now, to me, and I'm just putting this out to you, right? I don't have a big stake in this, so you can kind of go, no, you're wrong. But to me, knowing that I can be the eye in the center of the storm feels easier than having to memorize home so I can find my way back when I'm lost. And I don't know, does that even sound different to you, or what does that sound like to you?
You really like analogies.
I do. I know. I'm a little bit obsessive with them.
I think something different is going to work for everybody, and I think that's the beauty of life. You know, I don't shy away from pain, from suffering. I don't mind sitting in that, but I know there's something on the other side, and
yeah.
I don't know if
yeah.
If
see,
time
I,
is limited,
I
then it, I'd rather go, you know, take that pain and that suffering,
let it
wash through, and then turn my focus.
I'll tell you what I like in what you just said is you said, you know, there's something on the other side. See, that's really, I guess, what I was trying to get to. Is when we know there's something on the other side, when we know that peace is waiting for us, when we know that we will return home, we will get back, then it just makes the thought storms less scary. However, I agree with you, however we find our way, knowing there's something on the other side, it takes the edge off it.
It sure does. I agree.
Yeah. Yeah, beautiful. Thank you, Vanessa.
Thank you.
You know, I think that's so much at the heart of this is when we see that this is innate, this is natural, this is our nature, this is who we are at core, then we'll all find our way. I completely agree. And some people will find their way through practice, and other people will find their way just through understanding. But if you don't know that happiness is home, if you don't know that happiness isn't an accomplishment, it's what you're made of, then you're just liable to set off in a different direction. And ironically, in a direction that over time takes you further and further away from home and reinforces the idea that you're not already there. We can get so lost in our realities, in our thought-created realities. And I think Vanessa's other understatement there was, I like analogies. I'm obsessed with analogies. But I think the reason that I value analogies so much is because we know they're not true, right? It can't become a debate. It's just a way of pointing to something that you can recognize, but you can't really describe. You know, a guy in a class that I was teaching this morning was sharing that he was talking to a group of scientists. And he asked them, where do thoughts come from? And he said it was an amazing conversation, because ultimately nobody knows. You know, we know what happens in the brain that we can connect with the appearance of a thought, but that doesn't tell us where it comes from. Because where it comes from is nowhere. It's nothing. It's no thing. And if I call it mind or God or the void or the emptiness, even that is really just a metaphor. It's just a way of trying to point to something that can't be seen with the eye. It can be sensed with the heart. It can be heard with the soul. You can get a feel for it. But you can't really describe it, because in that description, you've created something from it. You've made it into a thing, something. And that's what we do, and that's the game of the spiritual journey, is finding our way home and then finding ways of pointing ourselves and others back for those moments when it looks like we've left. But the thing is, you could no sooner leave home. You could no sooner change that fundamental nature of innate health, of innate mental health, of innate well-being, then the nature of a frying pan would change if you cooked an egg in it versus a piece of chicken. The frying pan's just a frying pan, no matter what is cooking inside it. You are a perfect potential, an infinite creative potential. You are the formless nature of the universe. And whatever has been created in that or through that up until now doesn't change who and what you are. Worthy doesn't enter into it, because there's nothing you could do to be a more worthy frying pan or a less worthy frying pan. There's nothing we can do with an infinite potential that makes that potential any less infinite. That's as true in the physical universe as the metaphysical one. Right? Energy can neither be created nor destroyed. It can only change forms. So this is my memory of high school physics, so this might be a little bit off. It's been a little while. But what I remember is that energy was always described as being in one of two forms, in potential energy or kinetic energy, where it was actually in use. And they didn't describe it as, well, there's no energy and now there's some energy. It's just either potential energy or kinetic energy. Well, that's the life force. Right? That's the difference between the quick and the dead. And sometimes that energy, that happiness, that is just there in potential. And sometimes it's in use, it's in action. It's expressing through us in our lives. Same energy. And there's something about knowing it's there that seems to do a body good. There's something about knowing that we can never lose it. We can only get distracted. We can only lose our bearings. That makes life less scary. And when life's less scary, people are able to be more present. They're more inclined to try new things. They're more inclined to allow themselves a fresh start instead of trying to hang on to all the thoughts and ideas and beliefs and experiences of the past. You can start fresh right now. You do not have to be a victim of your past. You do not have to be a victim of your personality. You do not have to be a victim of what you have cooked in the frying pan up until now. And one of the things that happens, I remember working with one of Don Miguel Ruiz's apprentices years ago. And she explained to me the Four Agreements, if you've not come across one of the more famous books in latter-day personal spiritual growth, that the idea of the Four Agreements was not as a, this is how you must live if you want to be a good person. It was, these are the four ways that we most commonly give our energy away, that we most commonly turn that potential energy into kinetic energy that then gets wasted. When we don't keep our agreements, that takes an extraordinary amount of energy. And when we keep our agreements, we get that energy back. When we make assumptions, that takes an extraordinary amount of energy. And when we don't make assumptions, when we're simply present and available, all that kinetic energy comes right back to us as pure potential. Each of the agreements just points to a way that we dissipate our life force. And when we get it back, we experience the power that we are, the power that we have, and life seems easier. Right? You ever have a toy at Christmas and it ran brilliantly when the battery was full? Like, you know, some of those remote control cars or planes or helicopters. And then, you know, when the battery started dying down, it could barely make it over a, you know, a little incline in the sofa. But when the battery was on full, it could climb over furniture and people and everything and pets. Well, that's us. The less we're dissipating our energy, our life force, our potential in the pursuit of this imaginary happiness that looks like it's going to come to us from something that we do or something that we have or somewhere that we get to, the more we have available to live our lives. And if you're living your life with a full battery, you're going to do really well. And when the battery runs down, because it will, because our energy does get used up temporarily, well, then it's nice to be able to come home and recharge. It's nice to be able to plug back into the mains overnight. And then we're right back to it. We don't live to be plugged in. But boy, is it nice that no matter how drained we might get, we're only one charge away from being as good as new. And that charge is just resting in the happiness that we are. It's resting in the well-being that we are. It's resting in the peace that we are. It's resting in the infinite creative potential that we are. So if you want to keep this conversation going, if you go to Facebook, facebook.com/MNeil, there's an interview that we just put up there from a show called Born Happy, where we talk about this in an interview form, and there's some different ideas in there, some different thoughts, some different metaphors, some different questions. Check us out online, supercoach.com. We've got some new programs coming up, and we got lots of free stuff going on there right now. And I just want to thank you for being the space that draws this out of me each week. Because I'm pretty sure that if you weren't listening, I wouldn't be talking. And if I wasn't talking, I wouldn't get to see what I see with so much clarity or so much depth. So till next time, have fun, learn heaps. And I'll talk to you soon. Bye-bye for now.